Here, if you would line up, please state your name and address your question to one of the panelists. And again, the panelists are very welcome to comment on the responses of the other panelists. So please jump in.
Yes, I'm Philip Hughes from the White House Writers Group. I have a question and two brief comments for John Wilson and a suggestion, if I may, for Professor Rinn. Picking up on a point that Ellis Sandoz made, that you know this isn't a parlor conversation or a philosophy seminar. There are consequences and imperatives for action. I'd ask you, Professor Wilson, what exactly then should we as a government do in a world of Nairobi and Dar es Salaam bombings, of USS Coles, of 9/11s, of Richard Reed shoe bombers, of a still unsolved anthrax attack in Florida and in Washington, of Madrid and London train and subway bombings? What exactly should we do to leave personal liberty undisturbed and not result in the near strip searches of grandmothers, as you described, going through airport security or other facilities security? My comments, I guess, quickly are these. Your concluding phrase about our role in the world, as small as possible, consistent with our values and our safety. That prompted me to wonder, is that one of those conservative contradictions that Ken Cribb was referring to? Or is it really just a facile intellectual cop-out, since our values and our safety, given our size and our wealth, preclude small? Second comment, you know, we all contribute to the conservative movement in different ways. Some of us have written learned books. Some of us have written thoughtful articles, provocative articles, in leading conservative journals, and in other ways. A few of us have devoted substantial slugs of our careers to public service. In my case, most of it was in the Reagan administration. So it's, to say the least, a little surprising now to learn that we, many of us who've contributed through our public service in that way, come across as ideologues, blinded or blindly or stupidly expanding state power at the expense of our values and principles. It's a bit surprising to learn. Let me suggest, if, as Ken Cribb suggested, we're all going to go forward together wherever we're going, we need to do so with a modicum of mutual respect based on sensitivity and a sophisticated understanding of complex reality. My suggestion for Professor Rinn is this. Professor, might you someday reread your remarks today, perhaps to a gathering of conservative veterans, but striking out the word terrorism and substituting for it communism, and then consider where your remarks would place you on the spectrum of U.S. opinion and conservative opinion, say at the height of the Cold War?
I don't have a prescription. The caution I was making was just that. It was a caution, and I certainly was not standing forth to call any particular individual an ideologue. There is a difference between, however, the exercise of principle and the slipping into the kind of ideology that takes us away from the very prudential considerations that have allowed us to retain our liberties. There's cost, and I was here to point out that cost. As a matter of fact, when I said that sometimes we have slipped into ideological formulations by intention and sometimes by circumstances, that certainly is the truth. We did not knock down the Twin Towers. It was other people, and we have to deal with that sort of thing. And as a matter of fact, I have a great deal of sympathy for many of the things that Midge was saying about the reality of what we're faced with. It's just that If we don't keep in mind that there are costs to slipping over that line, then we indeed operate at our peril insofar as the most important long-range thing is concerned, our liberty.
We all know about self-evident truths in the Declaration of Independence. It suggests, I think, that there's a human nature. I think it's also a Christian notion that humans, wherever they are around this planet, share some things in common. I don't think it's a Jacobinical project to consider in a global world what that common human nature demands and what we can do to help people elsewhere exercise the rights that we believe they have. And it need not be utopian, and it need not be imprudent, and it can be just.
I'm a Cold Warrior. When the Cold War seemed appropriate, for the better part of the Cold War, I lived in a different country, and I was, I think I haven't counted, but one of four, maybe five, supporters of the Vietnam War in all of Sweden. That was a different time, completely different circumstances. The Soviet Union had intercontinental missiles, nuclear-tipped, directed in our direction, and had made certain very provocative statements as to their intent. That was an international emergency. It does seem to me often that one of the problems with many conservatives is that they're still living in that era. They cannot somehow do without having the great enemy. One of the reasons the Neo-Jacobins were able to make alliances with many neoconservatives is that they still had hawkish impulses. They had to abandon the Democratic Party from which they came because their pacifism is too widespread. But in the Republican Party, there were still people aching for a fight and ready to enjoy American power. That's how that alliance came about. But the enemy, the great enemy with a capital E, is no longer there, except in the old-fashioned form of the devil, who, however, used to be up to whatever he's up to by acting on individual souls. What some people seem not to be able to do without is that big enemy, which will make them appear to be saviors of all of mankind for standing up to him in this world rather than where it really might count the most, namely in individual souls.
Thank you. This is directed to Bill Dennis and others, perhaps. I come back that a democracy cannot run a coherent imperialist policy, if you will, because of domestic pressures. But the bright scene of globalization that you mentioned, how can we have that when nearly a quarter of the world's population is coming to hate the United States? And these elements are being encouraged by groups here. I got an email from townhall.com promoting a human events article that Mohammed was using 21st century standards for a 7th century prophet, that he was a murderer and child molester, and how evil Mohammed was. So, and you listen to the late night conservative talk shows, the tremendous upwelling here. A quarter of the world's population, and it looks at us as the enemy, and polls all over the world say the United States is the greatest threat to peace, world peace, etc. General Odom spoke in Washington at the new office of the Independent Institute, foreseeing America being expelled from the whole Muslim world as the risk of the way things are going. Anyway, globalization. But some of us now on the libertarian side are arguing the only safety we have is in divided government. The best thing that could happen is that the Democrats get one of the next houses of Congress. That you leave this in the hands of Republicans, we have unending wars, bankruptcy of the country, the loss of our freedoms. We didn't give up our constitutional freedoms fighting the communists, who had tremendous, tremendous fifth column powers in the United States, tremendous support. We never gave up the Fourth Amendment, the Constitution, but now we're giving it up, encouraged by many conservatives in the Patriot Act, many aspects of the Patriot Act. The only way many of us feel that we are safe from ruinous deficits and destruction of our constitutional freedoms is divided government. Namely, which I'd like to ask the panel, which house would be better to give up? The House or the Senate? Normally, we want to keep the House, but I realize they're judicial things for the Senate, but maybe the panel would address that.
John, who are you addressing?
I'm sorry. That's fairly general, but I think it was to Bill Dennis that the view of globalization, when we are so hated, and let me add Turkey, we talk about democratization. The most successful movie in Turkey, which is now 80% anti-American, is a movie showing American commander in the field killing indiscriminately with what's called collateral damage and claiming he talks to God. This is the biggest movie in Turkey and among the Arabs in Europe, or Turks in Europe. But the question is to Bill Dennis, this globalization view, how do you foresee that with this kind of scenario? And, of course, the Congress question.
John, I don't have any answer for such a complicated thing, but there are polls and there are polls. I think an Iraq that is free and pursuing its own cultural heritage, as we've encouraged. We haven't approached this war in a utopian fashion. We've helped restore the Marsh Arab culture. We've encouraged the Kurds to draw upon their ancient heritage. We've tried to make the Shia, give the Shias and the Sunnis a chance to live together as fellow members of the faith. The polls that matter to me are the ones in Afghanistan and Iraq. They voted, and they voted for us to help liberate them from their terror. And if we do that, the other polls in the world will come around too. And I don't notice too many people trying to get into other countries. All those millions out there in Pakistan and Turkey and Indonesia probably moved to America if they were given the chance.
I'd like to add something to that. You reminded me, Pat Moynihan once said, nobody ever got on a leaky boat to sail to Cuba. I think it's very important for us to remind ourselves that all those people in the Middle East or in Asia or wherever, they're like people. They are badly governed, and they are the victims of unhappy ideas and ideologies. But I assume, I've spent a lot of time in Jerusalem, and I know Palestinian Arabs, I know some. There's a woman there, she's got three kids. She feels about her kids the same way as I feel about mine. She feels about her life the same way as I feel about mine. She doesn't like to get kicked around, and she'd just as soon have nice clothes and eat decent meals and have a pleasant roof over her head. The world is full of people who would really prefer not to be kicked around. And very, very, very slowly, and with great difficulty, because there are millions of people who like to kick them around, it seems to me that the United States can, to some extent, bearing in mind that everybody in the world, ordinary people, want the same things we do, I think we can steadily remind ourselves that what we have is something that most people would die for.
Mm-hmm. That's just the kind of sentiment that I was talking about.
I know.
Before.
It's the second time I've been called a Jacobin by you.
By the way. By the way, this is the first time I've ever been addressed as comrade.
It's good for you.
Okay. I was just about to say that that kind of sentiment that the whole world craves just what is on the mind of the ordinary American is the kind of utopianism and conceit that is our problem. And there's another problem that goes with this. We're posturing in a way that is, it seems, perfectly designed to accomplish the objectives of the terrorists. We are trembling in our boots. We're talking all the time about terrorism. We are cowered. We are afraid. What are we going to do? We have to mobilize. This is giving them a, attributing to them a significance that is way out of proportion with the threat. And we build entire ideologies to justify our wielding our power. A lot of people, not least in this room, simply put, enjoy wielding American power and bullying other people. But it's going to be, there's going to be a backlash, and we've heard a great deal about it at this conference.
Ed, you wanted to jump in?
Well, not specifically on that discussion, but but comment was made about the USA Patriot Act. Most of the criticisms of that act have been made by those who've never read it. The only concern I have about it, frankly, was the title, because by using the word patriot, it made it an immediate target for the ACLU, which doesn't like anything patriotic. But if you actually look at the situation, it was said we didn't give up any Fourth Amendment rights during the Cold War. Actually, all of the investigative processes that are set forth in the Patriot Act and applied to terrorism were in existence and used during the Cold War. There's nothing new in there as far as an investigative technique, except increased judicial scrutiny of some of those techniques. So the USA Patriot Act is hardly a threat to the Constitution. It's, through our elected representatives, a representation of the Constitution.
Are there any other further comments from the panel?
Okay. Preston Knoll, Tradition, Film, and Property. I have a very brief comment and a question for Klaus Rinn. I comment on General Bunting's, I think, brilliant presentation yesterday. I think that his prescription at the end that we need a much larger military should be taken to heart first. That's my first comment. And my question for Professor Rinn. First of all, I have to say that I always enjoy when Professor Rinn's on the rostrum, because it, even early in the day, it gets my juices flowing. And my question has to do with a comment that he made in his presentation, having to do where he said that we wish to be, I guess the Jacobins, wish to be armed to the teeth, relentlessly pursuing the enemies. There's something close along that line. My question is, if you're hunting bear, do you load with birdshot?
Obviously not. It's tempting to try to handle questions like that in a few glib sentences, but the problem is precisely that the problems are so complex. What I'm resisting is, and I do not yield on this point, the neo-Jacobin impulse. Students of history, students of political theory, have no difficulty, if they reflect on the matter, recognizing the clear similarities between the arguments made by Max Boot yesterday and the arguments made by people like Robespierre and various others, who were, of course, deriving much of their intellectual firepower from the likes of Rousseau. They were for freedom, equality, and brotherhood. They knew exactly what the world, what the population, the suffering masses needed. One model fits all. Now, there is a difference between the old Jacobins and the new ones. The French appointed France as the missionary power. This time around, it's the United States. But the presumption, the conceit, the ideological mindset, the utopianism are virtually identical. Now, when it comes to addressing the question, what are we to do, that is a very complex question, because circumstances are never the same. No one model fit all cases. But one thing that we need to do, first of all, is to drain our minds and imaginations of this utopianism. And what is it doing in a place like the Philadelphia Society? American conservatives, it seems to me, not all, but many neoconservatives, they behave as if nothing had happened. And they put on these celebrations of the triumphs of conservatism. What world are they living
in? Perfect. Now, sorry, follow up. Professor, do you really believe that it's utopianism to try and defend our country when we are attacked by an enemy who is able to pull off that attack on 9/11? I mean, that was no small feat.
Of course.
And we're still suffering psychologically from that. I think America has woken up, in a sense. It's like a little child that's grown up and has never been assaulted.
Of course we defend ourselves, but we do it in a smart way, without becoming raving ideologues.
Anyone else from the panel like to make a comment?
Victor Borlier, Randolph Foundation. This is for one of the panel members for whom it is rumored to have recently published a book, Ed Follner. the book may have the answer to this, but with all the talk about whether or not we're an empire, this, that, or the other thing, and the importance of values and vision at the base, ultimately all these programs need to be funded. And what I see is one of the bigger problems emerging for us as a nation is the empire of debt. And this is true not simply of the federal government, which is where it is rampant. In fact, I think as much as I appreciate so much of the current administration, it reminds me very much of the Great Society in terms of guns and butter. But the juggling of statistics, anybody who believes that the inflation rate is only at 3% hasn't been shopping in the stores. But leaving that aside, this is true at the individual consumer level. It's true at the village city level, it's true at the state level, it's true at every funding special authority that we are on this game plan. We're gonna fund this empire not by getting tribute from the foreign colonies, but by borrowing from them. And what it strikes me is eventually historically, these kinds of debt bubbles burst. And I see nothing happening to suggest that at any level, personal, business, local, state, federal, anybody is seriously talking about reining in this debt monster.
Thanks, Victor. That's I urge everybody to buy this book and read it. Is that, in fact, is one of the central themes of the book. The first question we ask is it the government's business? Should the government be doing the various things it is doing? And we have a whole series of recommendations ranging from moving toward generally accepted accounting principles to taking specific responsibility for earmarks to figuring out what to do about Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, which are the three big federal drivers. And I get into arguments all the time, both with our internal and external economists as to what is an appropriate level of debt, and somebody will argue that in terms of a percentage of our GNP, it is less than it was 10, 20, 50 years ago. Someone else will say, but the Chinese are buying too much of it, and if they ever pull out overnight, then we're gonna have big trouble, and back and forth. The fact is that these are central, both personal and political questions that we, as both citizens and as private consumers, have to come to grips with. And yes, you're right. Unlike some of my fellow panelists, however, I am a congenital optimist, and
I agree.
You're going to demur, Klaus?
Philip Hughes, again, from the White House Writers Group. This is a comment. I could direct it at any member of the panel, but I'll pick on Ken Cripp. I feel constrained to publicize a bit of penetrating and pithy wisdom of Bob Riley's last night after dinner. Prompted by the dinner, and it was Ken's brilliantly put together dinner, by the way, so hats off to ISI. But prompted by the dinner, when we got back, I asked Bob, what's the difference between a contrarian and a crank? Bob's answer, coherence.
Well, that's a loaded comment. I think I said my piece last night, didn't I? I didn't agree with a great deal of what I heard in last night's session. I agreed with other things that I heard. But I just make a plea again, that's what we're all about. I mean, to me it was helpful to bring Lucas in and hear his point of view, even though, it sort of denied the relevance of my entire career. But, you know, but still, that's what we're here for. I think we spend too much energy reading people out of the movement and being contemptuous of motives we're ascribing to third parties and second parties for that matter, and we need to have a spirit of openness. The way you get non-ideological is to be open to insight.
John Von Cannon, the vice president for development of the Heritage Foundation, has always told me the difference between a contrarian and a crank is $1 million contribution to your organization.
Boy, one is tempted just to sort of stop right there. But let me just say this, if I may, as a general comment. There's been talk, my good friend and colleague, Klaus and others at this meeting talking about utopianism. And it's a valid question, it's a valid concern, because we can get caught up in utopian dreams, and sometimes those fantasies can lead us far astray. But I wonder, is it any more utopian to talk about what might happen in the Middle East in terms of bringing about and helping to encourage freedom and democracy than it was to talk about bringing freedom and democracy to Eastern and Central Europe in the 1980s? You know, Ronald Reagan and others saying that the Berlin Wall would not exist for 1,000 years, as the leader of East Germany predicted. And yet, the wall came down, communism collapsed, and freedom and democracy have come to much of Eastern and Central Europe. And so I wonder, in that historical context, looking to history for possible lessons, is it so utopian to talk about freedom and democracy of one kind or another in that besieged and beleaguered part of the world that we know as the Middle East?
Now, those are very sweeping terms. Freedom and democracy, philosophers have spent centuries trying to define the words, and we bandy them about and pay almost no attention to the fact that they may have opposed meanings. I'd like to make a distinction between constitutional democracy and plebiscitary majoritarian democracy. The people who are pushing for democracy or freedom do not devote much energy to thinking through those issues, which is irresponsible. And why is it, even here at the Philadelphia Society, that we're using what used to be called the language of the left, democracy, democracy, democracy? The framers didn't care for democracy, especially not for pure, what they called pure democracy. They were about constitutional republicanism. We shouldn't have democracy, too much opportunism, demagoguery, et cetera, short-range thinking, et cetera, et cetera. So it seems to me that a fundamental requirement would be that at least these terms are sorted out. And then another and even more acute question opens up. And it's this: where might freedom, as we understand it, take root in the first place? The framers knew very well that the reason that freedom had become possible in this country was a certain kind of responsibility that was related to certain traditions, the Christian tradition, not least, the English tradition, the rights of Englishmen, American constitutional traditions. It was no coincidence that the Constitution of the United States was written here. Many people speak today as if freedom and democracy were some sort of natural condition. You know, all you need to do is remove dictators and it just flows. That's a different political universe from the one in which the framers lived. They knew that if you want to have freedom, you have to have a lot of restraint. You need to have almost moral heroism. Everybody knows what Franklin told that woman and asked about what the Constitutional Convention had produced. A republic, he said, if you can keep it. But what was the problem with keeping it? People might not live up to the inner restraints that were necessary to sustain this Constitution. Are we, in effect, doing that? I don't think so. That's why we may well be eroding our own constitutional structures, why we go crusading around the world to cover up what's really happening.
Just say quickly that, Klaus, I would suggest that you read the 49 pages of the National Strategy Security Statement, in which Mr. Bush does define democracy. And he does not say that democracy that he's talking about is the American-style democracy. One element of it, of course, would be multi-party elections, which have been held in Iraq. Another element might be to vote for a constitution, which happened in Iraq, so that we can see that there is evolving in Iraq a possible model for all of the Middle East.
Okay, Jeff?
Jeff Gator with Council for America, and indeed my question follows up on the exact discussion we've been having here. Mitch Decker talked about, brought in the 200-pound gorilla into the discussion earlier. Now let me drag in, the 1,000-pound elephant that we've somewhat circled around a little but never addressed directly. And that has to do with the role of a rise of fundamentalist Islamic thought. And it ties in with what you're saying here in terms of the Middle East here. If we move indeed to democratic elections, and if indeed governments are elected there or come to power like Hamas in the West Bank, or as we've seen in Afghanistan lately, the outrage that was raised over the possibility of executing this fellow for converting to Christianity. If this indeed reflects a rising view of the peoples there, especially Arabic and even non-Arabic in Afghanistan, Islamic peoples, is there down the road, not too far, a rise of something we haven't talked about here at all, and that's the old line of Professor Huntington, as a potential clash of civilizations? Is this a serious problem we need to be discussing and confronting, which we hadn't done here this morning, or is this not a serious problem as far as members on this panel who think about these things?
I would like to undertake the first answer to that question. There's no question that the rise of Islamic fundamentalism is a very, very serious element. That we had some hand in this, I think, by buddying with all the bad guys in that part of the world on the grounds, first of all, that they had the oil, and second of all, that what difference does it make? They have their own civilization and we have ours. So there is this rise. Nevertheless, it's very interesting to me that when there are natural disasters around the world, and we see these on television, those people are people, and they weep, and they have their children that they worry about, that the terrorist gangs now send out kids to kill themselves is something that I cannot believe that Muslim parents are happy with. And we know, for instance, that they find these kids. It's very easy to find screwed up kids. You can find them anywhere, even in Hillsdale College, I bet. And they find them, they twist their minds, they fill them full of ecstasy before they send them out to kill themselves. Now, I know there's a clash of civilizations. You can't convince me that because someone is an Arab, his heart doesn't bleed for a suicidal kid. And I offer this not because I like to talk sweet talk, but because it's foolish and I think unpleasant for us to imagine that there is no appeal to someone from American benevolence. Our culture horrifies them. It horrifies me, so why shouldn't it horrify them? There are lots of things they don't like. Okay, but for us to, for the American benevolent impulse which is part of this policy, as it was in the Cold War, for that impulse to be put down as something other than what it is, seems to me to be really, really unfortunate. And I am sure that there is a great appeal to be made in the Middle East if we but stopped, which we have now begun to stop doing, holding hands with the bad guys and found our true friends and allies, of which there are many. As you mentioned, we ought to be reaching out to people in the world. Well, there are such people in the Arab world, and it's the height of Western arrogance to assume that there aren't. And those are the people we should be reaching out to. We should be embracing the way we used to say during the Cold War, there are true Democrats in Eastern Europe and Central Europe. And instead of dealing with governments, we ought to be reaching out and embracing those people. And some of us did that. And in the end, it bore fruit. And I cannot believe that millions upon millions of people, simply because they are Arabs, and simply because they are Muslims, are necessarily pledged to terror and murder.
Thank you, Mitchell. Got time for just one more comment.
I'm concerned that so many of the people who bring up the so-called clash of civilizations seem to be aching for a fight. They sort of enjoy the fact that there is a clash of civilizations. We have to mobilize. We have to be always on the alert, and so on. Now, something that ought to be done with at least the same amount of energy is to explore the points on which civilizations do not clash. Now, there's a very strong tendency when discussing that issue to define, for example, Western civilization as everything from 1789 and forward. There's Western civilization as enlightenment civilization, with all of what it means by way of freedom and democracy, etc. I think that even Samuel Huntington is prone as somebody standing in the liberal tradition in that direction. What we do not explore is the fact that the civilizations understood historically, great civilizations of the world, the traditional civilizations, share a great deal of common ground. And there is a ground to be cultivated. Now, I've spent quite a bit of time in China and have discovered that I find more people thinking like me at a place like Beijing University than even here at the Philadelphia Society. Figure that. And that does not mean that they are representatives of red China. It is because they are reaching for their old traditions, Confucianism. And you have similar developments in other parts of the world. Now, here is something that people of a conservative, cosmopolitan outlook might want to do something about and encourage. We can meet, to some extent, have cordial relationships in spite of our differences. Now, when Alan Bloom wrote his The Closing of the American Mind, people who may not be able to read thought it was a classic of conservative educational philosophy. The mind whose closing Alan Bloom bemoans is the Enlightenment mind, which he associates with Socrates. Figure that. But in any case, that's how he does it. Why, when we're talking about civilization, are we chopping everything off, which is prior to the Enlightenment, and even at the Philadelphia Society?
Victoria,
thank you very much.
Oh, shoot.
I'm sorry.
You're done? All right. I was just going to say, I thought that's what we were, what I was saying, too. You know, I'm for all the diversity in the world. We're not trying to create a uniform globe. We're drawing upon all these people and helping them live their own lives. And so we have another thing we agree on here at the table.
Good. Well, this has been a wonderful panel, and I thank you very much for your attention, your participation. And I'm going to ask Bill Campbell if he'd come up to make a closing comment. Bill?
I'll just do it from here. I'll be very brief. never met a what was it, a crank and a contrarian. Never met a contrarian I didn't like. Unfortunately, in the Philadelphia side, I've never met a contrarian, but I have met a lot of cranks, and and we love you all, so we appreciate your contribution. But I would particularly like to point out that the Philadelphia side is sort of a family operation, and I want to thank Victoria Hughes for the wonderful job that she's done putting this meeting together. And also thank her husband, Philip Hughes, who was very, very helpful on the foreign policy topic, so that's that family connection. I'd also like to thank my wife, I don't know where she is, and my daughter, and my son-in-law, and my granddaughter, who we are working on for the first fourth-generation family. We have about 20 years to go with her, but we are working to establish that tradition. But I also want to remind you to put the dates October 13th and 14th on your calendars. This is going to be the meeting in Pittsburgh. A tentative topic would maybe morphed into something slightly different, but war and peace and Western civilization, grand historical scope, more than public policy type topic, but we will refight the French and Indian Wars since we're in Pittsburgh, and that should be some amusement for most of us. I think we might have that in common. But anyway, we will be exploring the roots of America in terms of the French and Indian Wars, the American Revolution, and the more general topic of war and peace. So Pittsburgh is a great city, and I think you'll enjoy being there, and it's a very good time of year for that. So put that on your calendar, and we'll see you there. Godspeed on your travels home. Thank you.